Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for downloading the podcast. I'm John Montgomery. And for our first podcast of the new decade, we're going to be starting a multi-part look at the feature film Avatar that, of course, came out in December. And today, Mike Seymour is going to be speaking with Senior Visual Effects Supervisor Joe Lettieri from Weta Digital. But before we get to that, I just want to do a bit of a plug for our fxphd.com training site. It's a new year and a new term, and we feel we've got one of the strongest, if not the strongest, top-to-bottom term ever over at FXPhD. We've got 41 total courses we're offering this term, and that includes 11 new ones. And it kind of breaks down the following by the numbers. We've got 15 courses covering compositing type applications and tasks, 7 design and motion graphics style courses, 10 courses on 3D or simulation, and 5 courses featuring cinematography and on-set issues. And as always, one of the things that makes FXPhD great are the working professionals who share their knowledge on the site. And we've added some fantastic profs this term, including AE scripting guru Lloyd Alvarez, Mental Rays Master Zap Anderson, as well as Andrew Lowell, Michael Garrett, David Blum, DOP Tom Gleason, and my friend Brian Higgins. Now, Brian's going to be teaching our new Introduction to Smoke on Mac course, which should be a lot of fun. And the cool thing about it is that we're actually going to have Smoke on Mac available over the VPN. And what that means is that if you're a member of FXPhD, you'll be able to run the software for the duration of the term and not have it run out after the 30-day trial version. So that's pretty cool. In addition to that, I'm going to be teaching a intermediate-level flame and smoke combo course. So it'll kind of go hand-in-hand with that, covering issues that kind of work across both applications. So it's going to be a lot of fun. Thanks to those of you who kind of follow us at both sites. I appreciate you sitting through a bit of a plug because actually, frankly, one of the reasons we're able to do the stuff at FX Guide and give you FX Podcast, Red Center, FX Guide TV, FX Guide TV in Espanol, why we're able to give you those things for free is because we've got money coming in from our pay site, fxphd.com. So I think it's a bit of a small price to pay. Well, getting back to our subject for this week, Avatar is just killing it, obviously, at the box office with over $1.1 billion taken in. It's recording this on January 7th, and it looks poised to potentially take the all-time box office records. It's also been recognized for visual effects, making the VFX shortlist for the Oscars. The other films that made the shortlist are District 9, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, Star Trek, Terminator Salvation, Transformers Revenge of the Fallen, as well as 2012. And again, just simply a fantastic lineup of VFX work on the shortlist this year. But I guess if you believe the comments in the story on FX Guide, it seems as though Avatar is the favorite for that. But again, great work top to bottom for all the artists on those various movies. Well, let's go ahead and join the interview this week. As I mentioned earlier, Mike Seymour is going to be speaking with Joe Lettieri, who's a senior VFX supervisor at Weta Digital, the lead house VFX house on the film. And again, this is one of my favorite types of FX podcasts and considered the VFX geek out. So let's go ahead and join that conversation now.
So firstly, let me say thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Sure, no problem.
You really joined Weta for Gollum, is that not correct? If I just step back a bit for a second.
Yes, that's right. I arrived here right as we were completing the Fellowship of the Rings and started prepping for the Two Towers. And yeah, it was really Gollum that was the big focus of that show, and you know, my big interest in like doing character work.
And then, interestingly, of course, with Kong, you had not only the facial work, which had moved on even from Gollum, but then the jungles, which, of course, were primarily live action and miniatures and stuff, but there were some digital jungles in Kong, weren't there?
That's right, there were. And those are exactly the two things that led us into the discussions with Jim on doing Avatar. You know, the fact that with Gollum, we had learned a lot about you know, a character and a performance that can actually work either with other actors, you know, side by side, or stand on its own and carry scenes on its own if need be. With Kong, we experimented more with facial motion capture, because on Gollum, we couldn't do facial motion capture. Gollum was entirely keyframed for the facial animation. For Kong, we were able to experiment with facial motion capture, so we got a good grounding in what we could do with that and how it could be applied. But then from a character point of view, you had similar issues. You had a character that had to work with other actors. You had a character that also had to be able to carry scenes on his own with the, you know, added little trick that he had no dialogue. So it all had to really be done through the facial performance. And so those are a couple of things that Jim was really interested in, because we'd spent so much time developing the ideas of character and character performance, and then building big landscapes. He mentioned the jungle. Yes, a lot of it was done with miniatures, but towards the end of Kong, we started doing more and more jungles that were just completely digital, because as shots and things would change, we didn't have time to go back and reshoot the miniatures, so we started building digital versions of the jungles. And also with New York, we had created this kind of tool for growing the city, and we thought that we could adapt something similar to the idea of growing a jungle. So all of these things kind of came together in our discussions about how are you going to bring this story to the screen? How would you make these characters be alive? Because, you know, once we get away from the human world of Hell's Gate and get out into the jungle, it's all the Na'vi and the Avatars. That's all you're playing with is just these digital characters having to carry the scene and interact with each other in, of course, these big virtual environments. So yeah, that's really what's the word for it? Sort of that genesis, or, you know, going from Gollum to Kong to the Na'vi and to the Avatars. That there was definitely a connection there and a learning curve that we built on.
But to take nothing away from that lineage, there is also actually some important differences, because you were, for example, with Gollum, motion and performance capturing to place into a live-action plate.
That's right.
But in terms of an on-set environment, this was very much that the directing of what you might call the plate photography was, in fact, the capture. And so that really put a completely different spin on it in one sense, didn't it?
That's exactly right. That was one of the big breakthroughs of this film, is that rather than putting things into a plate and having to match to the plate, actually making the virtual set be the same as a live action set. You know, Jim was out there with the camera staging and blocking and working out his shots and art directing, you know, bits of the scenery and moving lights around, and anything that you could do on the stage within the limited context of real time to kind of rough out the idea, he was doing it, and that was completely the breakthrough. You're right.
I want to get into the especially the final quality of the characters, but just to set that up from the staging point of view, there's been much discussion of the fact that there was a virtual camera on set, which I actually believe there was early stuff on that on Lord of the Rings, because on Lord of the Rings, I believe in one of the orc attacks near the well, there was Peter Jackson had a virtual camera. But my point was that in this particular situation where you're trying to do real-time feedback to give effectively the eye that's to the eyepiece, in other words, Jim Cameron's eye, what he's seeing, you have a bit of a problem, don't you? Because in one sense, to get the finesse of a character's performance in terms of their face, that's a heck of a lot of computational power. And yet, if you take your eye off the eyepiece to see the actor's facial performance, you're no longer seeing them in the virtual environment. Did you manage to solve that adequately enough that he could judge the performance and judge them in a digital environment?
It was always a hybrid methodology that we would use. You know, for example, we had that exact same thought. What if you could actually see the characters' faces in real time as you're capturing them? Right. We knew we could do the bodies. We knew we could put all the set elements out there. Faces were something that eluded us. So when Jim was coming down to actually have his very first meeting with us, we thought, why don't we go for it? Why don't we just see if we can do this and show that to him? And so we did this like 6 weeks, just kind of, you know, 6 weeks basically worth of all-nighters, and we developed a real-time facial system. And when he came here, he walked on the stage, we were able to show him that. And you could show that it actually could be done. But there's two things you have to consider now when you're doing that. One is it's an incredible amount of data. So the more data you carry in the system for the face, the less you have for multiple characters and set pieces and things like that. So because it's real time, right, it's almost like a game, you're working within a fixed budget of what you can play back in real time. So you have to limit what you can put into the face. you know, you got, you know, for a character like Neytiri, close to 1,500 shapes that you might have, you know, in the facial system. On the stage, you're going to be lucky to be able to work with 50. So you kind of have to pick the ones that you think are going to be the most valuable for showing your performance. And then also just the idea, as you said, about taking your eye on the away from the eyepiece. What started happening is that as a style, Jim would block in the actors, block in the staging and everything that he wanted, but he would watch the performance so he knew he was directing them to get the performance that he wanted, because then he knew that as long as we had the face captured, we'd be able to, you know, recreate that later on. So
in that early test, had you moved yet to having the camera on the helmet, or is that still not there yet?
Yeah, no, that early test was showing with the camera on the helmet.
Right.
We did our very, very early tests with marker dots, because the thing about marker dots, which is what we did for Kong, you're limited in your space and your performance and so forth, of course, but your data is absolutely accurate in three-dimensional space. You know, so you have like 150 markers on Andy Serkis's face for Kong. You have dead-on accurate data, but you can only move within a very small volume. When we decided to go with a single camera rig, you have to still recreate that three-dimensional data, but you only have one two-dimensional perspective. So we had a whole other problem to solve there, which is how do we know from the two-dimensional data that we have the accurate data in 3D? And so that was a whole other step. So
Naive question there?
Yeah, go ahead.
And maybe it's just too simplistic, but it just struck me that the more obvious thing would have been to put two cameras with some kind of stereo split on the head rig, not because you wanted to capture stereo for the film being stereo, but just so that it would give you the triangulation you'd need for three-dimensional data specs.
Yep, that's exactly right. And we considered that. We considered three cameras. We considered four cameras. The more cameras you put on, the heavier and more unbalanced the rig becomes. It becomes more cumbersome for the actors. They've got to carry two data recorders that you now have to keep synchronized, you know, to get the data through. It becomes a much more complex problem from a production point of view.
Right.
Even just keeping two cameras registered is a real problem. And so we decided that that was too hard, that it was going to be easier for us to solve the problem from a single camera. A single camera was just easier for everyone to work with, and in Jim's mind, that's what he wanted. He thought that would be the ideal system, is just a single camera. So you're right. We lived with the limitations and figured out a way to solve the 3D out of the one camera.
So you've got, obviously, the ability to scan an actor's face, and notwithstanding, of course, performance, you know, the yeah. actual shape of someone's face doesn't change, or head structure doesn't change because of the skull. So I'm wondering, at this stage, when you're still capturing the information off them, is the fidelity to get to the musculature really all the way there? Because it seems to me that it's a problem of not just working out what the points are moving in 3D space, but as you said yourself, from Kong, you knew it was all about working out what the muscles were doing to provide that movement that happens
That's
in 3D space.
Right. Yeah. It as an automatic process, no, it's not completely there. It's not a push button process. And again, that's something we knew going into it. You know, we used as much tracking and solving technology as we could to really, you know, help us along. But in the end, it's actually a team of artists looking at this data and trying to figure out, you know, to make the call on the interpretation. But we built the system so that it was basically a learning-based system. If we saw a new shape that that the system hadn't encountered before, we could input it into this sort of learning database and add that to our solve, and then the next time it encountered it, it would be able to do that. Because you have to remember also, when you're looking at a camera-based system, you don't see just the face of the shape. The shape of the face. You also see all the lighting changes that are happening on set. You know, because they're moving around. There's shadows that are moving around. So the same expression might look different if they've got somebody in front of them blocking some of the light versus not blocking the light. You know, the camera doesn't know that that's the same expression.
But you mentioned training it.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, I'm saying, but you're even indulging my understanding of this, because you say an expression, but of course, if Sigourney's acting a scene across her face, there's kind of almost more than one expression, and they overlap.
That's right. They do overlap. But what we're able to do is frame by frame, you know, is analyze the position of the markers and use that to derive at least the main muscle groups and understand how they're working together. So you get the overlap just by doing that frame to frame. But, you know, again, you're right, the expressions overlap. So sometimes to a tracking in a solving system like that, it's not going to know the difference between some of these intermediate poses. And again, that's where we rely on the artist to build up a repertoire of what these things actually mean. So the whole solving system is really like an extensible animation system. And in fact, it's built to be flexible enough that you can actually just go from the solve straight into keyframe animation if you need to edit anything. And that's all based on, going back to what we did with Gollum and Kong, the idea that we use a FAX system, you know, to solve for the muscles. And I don't know if you're familiar with FAX or if we need to describe that.
Oh, I think we should describe it, yes.
Okay. So FAX is a facial action coding system. And it was developed by Paul Ekman. And what it does is it's basically a way of doing actually what it says, coding expressions in the face. So when you have a particular expression, you can give weights to certain muscles and certain muscle groups in the face, and you can describe how they are activated, to what strength and in what combination to create the expression that you see. So what we're doing when we solve is we are looking at all the points on the face, and we are trying to derive from those points what are the muscles that must be engaged here and to what degree. And then we use that to drive the muscles on the character. And that's really the key to the performance, because what we're trying to do is to understand what the emotion is by understanding, by reading what muscles are engaged. So you're not taking the geometric data from one face and targeting it to another face. You're actually solving for the underlying muscle activations and then activating the same muscles to the same degree on your new character.
Now, in the case of Kong, you, I think, said in an interview that there were the same fundamental muscles, but not exactly the same as in a human.
That's right. Yeah.
Is the digital actor in Avatar got the same musculature and relationship to muscles as a human face, or is it just slightly different as it was in the case of Kong?
No, we treated it the same way. We used the same muscles that you would have in the human face. Obviously, the layout and the attachment points are slightly different because, you know, the jaw is more elongated, the nose is wider. We wanted to get some of the characteristics, for example, of what a lion might do with its nose. So, you know, we made the activations different. Some of the muscles could pull more strongly in certain directions than they could on a human. But we used the same basic human layout to drive everything.
Because there was a cat influence, wasn't there, or a cat
fan
influence?
Yes, absolutely. The Navis have that sort of cat influence. The lion nose, the yellow eyes were really inspired by lions. They have the cat-like ears and tail. Yeah.
So let's say that we've got the data now and we've moved on from the camera. Actually, I have one last question on the camera, I should say. Did you actually at any time just map the video that you're getting from the feed from the helmet onto the face?
Yeah. That's a good point. We didn't do that in real time, but that was always done for editorial.
Right.
The camera feed was mapped directly onto it. We called it the Kabuki mask. And that was always done so that Jim could see the actor's performances, and then you could always just go back and look at the reference track, and you saw that it was the same thing in sync. So for the most part, that's actually what we relied on, was the mapped video. The times we're doing the real-time data really helped out as we had big action movements. You know, if the character was growling or, you know, something really big where you saw the jaw movement and you saw it at a distance. Because with a map video, you don't get that, and that changes the profile of the face, and you can read that pretty clearly. So Jim would pick which way he wanted to go. So we always had the real-time running on stage, but then he would just pick whether or not he wanted to use that when he was assembling the shots and building his templates.
So you've got the data sets now, and in a sense, while it's tremendously beneficial to have a real rig on someone's shoulder, there's no reason that you can't take the camera that's going to film the action for the audience and place it anywhere. There's no constraint, obviously, once you've captured the data. But by the same token, isn't there the same issue that you could take any performances and mix and match them, and even in one performance, just remove an expression? Was there a remix of the acting? I know you were authentic as much as you could, but you obviously could do that.
No, there was, absolutely. We did a fair amount of that, actually. Because you have this captured data, and it's like tracks now. You know, you've got, for example, at the most basic level, you have a scene that you shoot, right? Jim likes the take that he's got. The actors can now go away, and Jim can do camera coverage on that. He can come in and do his over-the-shoulders and do his close-ups and build a whole scene out of just one take that he likes. If, for example, you're coming in off the master and you're doing the over-the-shoulder and you realize they're going quite position right, you need to get one of the characters slid in closer to camera a little bit more, it's no problem to just pick up that character's action and just slide them in for that one take. If you want to mix and match takes or offset timing, you can do that. Or if you want to just split a take right down the middle for some reason, you know, you like the actor's performance better on the first line from take one and the second line from take three, you can do that. So yeah, there was actually quite a lot of that went on.
So let's say now we're moving offset. We've got the data and the editorial decisions that go with it. I want to work out how you got from that to the realization that was on screen so effectively. And I understand that the actors got scanned in Light Stage 3. What was that for? Because that obviously would give you a particular lighting reference. But was it just used as reference, or was that actually feeding into the solution?
No, that was really done more for the lighting and the texturing side of it. Because we were, you know, scanning, you know, Sam Worthington and Zoe and Sigourney, and I think Joel David Moore, we did a number of the actors, you know, obviously just to get their head shapes and to make sure that we had that as the basis underlying the, you know, the models for the characters. But we just wanted to see what else we would learn from that by just actually looking at their skin texture, because we thought that would be part of the recognizability, you know, because for example, the avatars are a mix of human and Na'vi DNA. So Jake's avatar looks a lot like him. So we thought, well, why not mix a bit of Sam's skin in there and just, you know, you'd get a little bit of a hint of the skin pattern, the skin coloration, so that when you saw Jake, it would still look like Sam. So we did some things like that, and it was really just to validate what was happening with the skin as well, because one of the things that's usually done with light stage data is it's worked in an image-based mode. And we didn't want to work in an image-based mode. We needed shaders to do all of this, especially because we were creating the blue skin. But we used it to kind of validate and you know, working with Paul Debevic and his team there, actually extracting skin parameters that we could feed into our shaders. And so we used those to help validate what was happening in the skin so that we knew, even though we were turning it blue, we had a good physical basis, you know, for it to work from.
Were you using the ladder work from the light stage research that separated specular and diffused, or were you using it more in terms of the HDR sort of earlier research?
No, exactly. The ladder work, that's exactly what I'm talking about. The earlier work was HDR, and it was all image-based. Now, we used HDR as well, but we weren't relighting by combining images from the light stage.
So you've got very high-resolution scans, effectively, from the diffuse pass.
Yes, exactly, from the diffuse part, and then we also have some idea of how the basically the parameters are changing across the face.
Because the porous nature of the skin and how the pores react under the different expressions is so well captured, it seems, by that technology.
It is, and although if you really look at the detail that we needed, especially for these characters, we had to paint in more detail than we were able to capture from that, but it at least gave us a really good starting point. It was great to just to really look at it and understand the flow across the face. Now, I know you can also get that from a very high-resolution scan, but by working with the light stage, we were able to you know, do some analysis and extract some of the skin parameters, and as I said, that's really what we wanted. And so we decided to go that route rather than high-resolution scans.
I'm kind of interested in the shader BRDF solution for the skin because it's blue. And, of course, what you tend to want out of someone looking very, to use the expression, human, is warmer tones, softer subsurface scattering stuff. And I wonder whether the blue just was really fighting against that, even though, of course, it works artistically.
No, it was. It was fighting against it a lot. But I remember the first time I walked into the art department with Jim, and he showed me the sketches of the characters, and they were blue. I said, we're going to have to find a way to still keep the skin warm and make it look like they've got blood underneath it. And he said, yes, that's what I'm looking for. It's like, okay, let's think about that. And so we tried a number of approaches, and ultimately we just came to the idea that we would need a multi-layer subsurface, but we had to decouple the exterior color from the red color. So basically, we didn't filter the blue coming in as much as we should have. because that would have just not allowed any red light to return.
So you had just different spectral subsurface scattering.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that just became an artistic balance. You know, we kind of knew for human skin what it should be. You know, because they were bigger, we obviously had to work with the depth a little bit. We had to work with the color and how it just worked throughout the face and how it worked with the blue and, you know, and any of the blemishes in the skin, you know, we like the moles and things like that, we kept a little bit more on the warm side so that you really kind of understood them as skin blemishes in the way that you're used to seeing them. And we just kept really working that and trying in lots of different lighting situations until we felt that we had, you know, characters that would just work no matter where we put them.
Now, obviously Weta has an extraordinary render farm, but in the real world of getting shots done, did you have to use, for example, baked maps for subsurface scattering, either over multiple frames or even multiple shots for the wider stuff?
For the subsurface scattering?
Yeah. No.
We thought we would. We were going to try some sort of a compression approach like that, but ultimately we were able to get things running pretty efficiently, and it was easier to not have two different techniques. It was, in a way, easier to pay the compute price rather than trying to manage different ways of computing the same thing and trying to figure out when do you need which one. And, you know, because if you've got one shot where Jake's in the foreground and another shot where the camera pulls back and he's off in the distance, you want it to be consistent. You don't, from an artistic point of view, you don't really want to have to think about it. And in a way, that's what computers are for. So we'll just let them do the calculation.
So we've talked a little bit about the face stuff, but of course, again, people, I think, sometimes look at motion capture, performance capture, and assume that it gives you immediately all the musculature and skeletature of a movement. But of course, it doesn't. It just gives you points on an exterior that have to then be derived through a rig. And I'm wondering, did you have major rig advances to get that musculature on body movement, in particular outlying fingers, hands?
We did, because you're right. You've got the whole retargeting of the rig from human bodies to these non-human bodies. Even though they're similar, they pose their own sets of problems. But because the characters were basically, you know, naked so much of the time, or at least you were seeing a lot of their skin, we wanted to come up with a better solution for doing muscles. And we went through this whole R&D phase on Avatar on every aspect of our production. You know, we talked a little bit about the lighting and the facial, but we hit every aspect of what we do just to kind of see what's really the thing that we're trying to do here. And, you know, are we compromising too much because of, you know, in the past it just has not been possible to do these things. And one of the things we looked at is muscles. Muscles have always been influence objects and skin weights and clusters and, you know, things of that nature. But that's not what it is in the real world. And so we thought about, if we really want to solve the muscles realistically, what do we have to do? And the only thing that we can come up with based on all the literature and the way all these things have been solved is to just do a finite element model for the muscles. So that's what we decided to do. So we built finite element models for the main characters and solved their muscles that way. And that was really a big win for us once we got that working.
So let's imagine now we're placing our characters in the environment. You've got such computationally dense scenes. I'm wondering, if you're not doing any baking for the maps for the subsurface scattering and stuff, were you doing stuff like shadow map bakes, or were you doing anything to do with soft illumination pre-pass stuff? Or
yes, what we did there is we came up with a whole pipeline using spherical harmonics.
Right.
To handle that kind of illumination, the soft illumination, the ambient lighting, the stuff that in the past has always really just been approximated. Because when you're doing these exterior scenes, as you said, especially in the jungle, you know, it's all about the ambient lighting, because very little of the sunlight actually filters down there. And we figured the only realistic approach we could take to do that was to use spherical harmonics. So we built a whole pipeline using spherical harmonics where everything was basically pre-calculated, both individually and then against everything else in the scene. And we just did that for every shot just as a matter of course. And it worked out really well, because you pay the price up front to do the pre-computation, but once you're ready to sit down and light, it becomes really fast.
And now when you're going to the deeper parts of the shot that are no longer close to camera, did you need to go to kind of voxel solutions, or could you even use a mono matte painting because of the stereo nature of the production?
Yeah, for the most part, voxel transit solutions didn't work for us too well. We tried a few different ones, different types of point clouds and so forth. It was the same problem where they just looked different enough from what you were seeing close up that you had to manage it differently.
Right.
So ultimately, we used the same models. We would have decimated models, you know, that we could place in the background if we knew there was a point where they weren't going to get any closer to camera. You know, we'd obviously have some level of detail schemes. We used stochastic pruning for a lot of the trees and things that lent themselves to that sort of a technique. And yes, we did use map paintings. Once you're beyond a certain point where parallax becomes less of an issue, we did a lot of 2.5D, you know, projections onto geometry. And then for the very deep background, you could go with a flat map painting. You know, if you had a really high wide vista and you're seeing, you know, a kilometer or so beyond, at that point, you know, a flat map painting would suffice.
Yeah, I was wondering when you got to those floating mountains and stuff, whether you were just rendering super high-res frames and then reprojecting over simplified geometry just to give you stereo where you would maybe not have to do that in a mono film.
Yes, exactly. No, that's exactly right. One of the big things, and we weren't going to talk about stereo per se, but from the digital point of view, just to make everything work in stereo, we really had to not rely on any 2D tricks anymore. So anything had to be in a proper position in space. So any time that you did a matte painting, or in those few cases where we could use like 2D elements, they had to get projected on cards or cylinders or some simple geo to place them out in space. So the thing that we started actually doing is all of our renders, we are outputting depth-based information per pixel, so that all our compositing switched from being layer-based to actually being pixel-based. And we just pixel by pixel, everything was depth composited.
So coming back to the shaders now, because we've just touching on stereo, were you choosing to go down a RenderMan path that had a stereo shader, or were you going for the, you know, completely valid approach of doing entirely separate passes for left and right eye in the RenderMan pipeline?
Well, we did the RenderMan approach of stereo shaders, but that is completely valid because we actually work with Pixar on how to make that happen. That was from discussions that we had with them, saying, okay, we need to do Avatar and we want to do it correctly, but we want to do it efficiently. And so that's how that pipeline came into being.
So that there were so stereo shaders.
You actually do see all the correct stereo calculations being done with the stereo shaders. And yeah, we had to rewrite our whole shader pipeline to make that work, but worked quite well.
Because I mean, both would work, right? Because theoretically.
Both would work. We were just looking for efficiency.
Yeah.
And by doing it in the same shader, it just made everything easier to manage. Because one of the problems I found with stereo production is if you render something like left eye and you think this is good, okay, let's go ahead and render the right eye, at least half the time something comes out different, and you never know why. And it's just like, you know, rather than track it down, if we're saying we're rendering stereo, we're rendering both eyes together. And so that's what we did.
Now, I'd love to go into depth on stereo, and I'd love to go into depth a whole lot of areas for this, but there is one area I think that hardly I've seen any press on, and I think it's a shame, because in any other film, it'd have got an enormous amount of attention, and that is just the emotional impact of knocking a tree over. And I just want to just give it a little bit of attention, because it seemed to me that that in any other film, the guys that in your team that were working on the effects rendering stuff, in other words, the 3D effects, not 2D, did such a brilliant job with both the flames and the volume stuff that was in the, and that destruction sequence of the tree, just technically beautiful. Could you just talk to me a little bit about how you approach some of the effects rendering? Because those guys haven't had much attention in the press.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. There was a big, huge effort there to make that happen. It was a two-pronged approach because we handled, you know, fluid simulations for some of the scenes where he was in the water differently. We were using a new software called NIAID. We were partnering up with them. I don't know if you're familiar with that yet, but
no.
You'll probably start to hearing about it. Yeah, I think we were the first you know, customers of theirs to actually start using it, but they came and consulted with us for a while on that. So, you know, heavily particle-based for a lot of it. And then for the fire sims and so forth, you know, a volume approach still seems to work better than a particle approach. So that's the approach that we took. And, of course, you know, you have to simulate everything against everything. So you've got to, you know, make sure you've got all the parts of the tree in there that you're colliding the fires against and the smoke and so forth. And, obviously, having to make that work in stereo, getting the shaders to work for the smoke and the lighting, and getting it to work with all the other effects that are going on in there, including, you know, casting shadows onto the surrounding objects and having shadows cast onto them. It was really a big effort because of the detail that was required. You know, very long turnarounds on the simulation, long turnarounds on the rendering, and then obviously big scenes that everything was going into, so the renders themselves were fairly big.
I mean, you must have been, I know you were doing volumetric motion blur and stuff, because it's not as if you could do a 2D motion blur solution on this.
No, we do, true motion blur, yeah.
And that tree sequence, did that have a long period of R&D on it? Because it seemed to me that it was so both natural and, of course, simulated. I was wondering at what level you set it up and let it go, and how much it was sort of hand tweaked.
It was a lot of both, really. But you know, with the simulation, when you say tweaking a simulation, you know, you're just in there kind of changing parameters and running it again and seeing what you get. There's not much you can do to actually tweak a simulation once you have it, especially in the stereo world, because we were pretty close to a lot of those explosions and fireballs. And so a lot of your normal 2D kinds of tricks, you know, didn't work. But what we came up with was some ways to, you know, edit the explosions in 3D, you know, some basically Boolean type operations to combine you know, different caches together, or to clip away different parts of caches and try to shape it that way if you needed to. For the most part, we didn't need to do that, but there were, you know, times every once in a while where everything was looking good except for one little thing, and you know, if you resim it, you're just not going to get that back again. You know, you'll fix the other part, but you'll change everything else. And so there were times when we had to go in and just figure out ways to edit those caches.
Yeah, it's the great thing about simulations, isn't it? Is they actually simulate stuff, so you change some parameters and it changes the simulation.
Yes, it does.
Can we talk about the 2D pipeline? You mentioned that you were doing a pixel-based Z-depth stuff, though I also know that you're a big advocate of trying to get it right, especially when it comes to characters and subsurface in the renderer and not doing it as a multipass. What was the 2D pipeline and how did that work?
Well, for any particular object that we're rendering, we generally don't do it in layers, you know, so everything comes out fully rendered. The idea is, you know, what if we went and shot it live action? This is what you would get. But there's still a lot of breaking things into passes for a number of efficiencies, you know, just huge amounts of memory overhead for some of these scenes. You have to break it down just to get it through. A lot of times you'll break it down just because, you know, we know our camera moves locked down, let's get the environment rendering, but we're still working on the animation, so we know the character is going to be in another layer, you know. You've got all those kinds of issues. But, you know, if you're in a situation like that where you've got a jungle that you're moving through and you need to break the jungle down into layers, well, foreground, background doesn't necessarily work anymore, you know, because you've got plants all intermingled. Or if the characters are running through the jungles, there's times when you just traditional layering just does not work. And so you really need to know where each position is in space, especially with a lot of the volumetric effects. You know, when we did God rays, we actually did them as you know, volumes in space with scattering coming off of all the particulate matter, you know, floating inside of them. So if that's interacting with the trees or the characters are walking through that, that all has to be composited in space. So that was all done by just maintaining the depth information for every pixel and compositing it that way.
And so the primary tool for the compositing was Nuke?
The primary tool was still Shake.
Right.
Because we had, you know, the source code version of Shake, and so we adapted it to include all these tools. We also built a stereo pipeline for Shake. And then we actually consulted with the Foundry on what they were doing with Nuke, showed them what we had done, and they started using, you know, those ideas, I think, to take into Nuke. But because that was still kind of early days for them, they didn't have it to the level that we needed when we started. So we still use Nuke a lot for the things that's really good at, the very 3D, you know, heavy kinds of things, like helping to build environments and pre-passes and things like that. But because we just had Shake everywhere and everyone was so familiar with it, and we had like built this whole pipeline up in it, we stuck with that because it's not just compositors. You know, the TDs also need to be able to composite these things when they're lighting and look at things. And so we still needed something that worked across the board as our final compositing tool. So most of it was still shake.
Was that also the case with Ocular, that it was still at the early potential stage and hadn't really got past those some of those bugs?
Well, no, not so much, because Ocula was early days as we were early days, and we basically, you know, used Avatar as a test case for Ocula. We just hammered on Ocula and got that to work. But Ocula was a kind of thing where, yes, you could run those things through Nuke because it's kind of separate, you know what right. I mean? And I think a lot of the live action shots, like the scenes where they were waking up inside the ambient room, I believe those were just run through Nuke the whole way because that was just a small, you know, set of shots, and they did need a lot of tools like Ocula just working right in them. So it was a mix of how we used things, but we definitely used Ocula, and we used the vertical alignment tools and so forth to really help straighten things out for us, especially with the live action.
Well, that's interesting, because I know that in some shots ILM we're basically projecting the live action second camera to accommodate for not just vertical offset, but of course a slight twisting offset that just comes from a rig. Were you doing a similar kind of hardcore left to right eye adjustment? Because I know that was vendor based solutions that were required by Lightstorm.
Yes, no, absolutely. We did the same thing, the color balancing, lining everything up. Yeah, and we did that for everything.
So thank you so much for your time. I guess I just wanted to finish by just looking forward and saying, I presume from what I've read that a bunch of the base technology and approaches are things that are going to be feeding into things like Tintin and stuff moving forward. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. I think what we managed to do on Avatar is to really just look at the whole world of digital filmmaking. And yeah, as I mentioned before, we went back to ground zero and just reevaluated everything that we did. And we just built it into a pipeline that seems like it's a pretty good platform moving forward, you know, for plugging lots of these different things into, you know. If you wanted to look at facial capture, for example, with a multi-camera rig or some other system, that's no problem. It would fit into our solver still, you know, pretty well. If we wanted to change our lighting techniques, you know, no problem. The foundation is there. So it feels like, yeah, we've got a pretty good framework for accommodating anything that you need to do in a project, you know, from the spectrum, from full spectrum, from live action to digital. And I think just that style of working, just the thing to, you know, like we talked about with Jim, being able to direct scenes with a virtual camera and, you know, having other people pick up on that, like Peter and Steven looking at it for Tintin. I think you're going to be seeing that becomes more of a tool that lots of directors can use, because it provides a really, you know, easy entry into digital filmmaking, even if as a director you've never done it before, because the tools are very familiar from live action filmmaking.
Well, because you did sort of, to quote Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, sort of 15 impossible things before breakfast, looking back on the project, is there anything that you would have tackled differently with the hindsight? Because, I mean, you couldn't have possibly known all of this when you started the venture.
No, actually, I think the approaches that we took were pretty sound. I think I'm pretty happy with the way we, you know, went with everything. I wouldn't have changed the approaches we take on that we took on any of it. There are certainly things that we'll build on from here, and, you know, we know where we can go and how we can do it better. But you have to go through this step first, and I think these are all the right way to go.
Well, we do appreciate taking time to talk to us. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you, Mike. Good talking to you.
Well, thanks, guys, for that. Again, I really enjoyed listening to that podcast. I downloaded it last night and converted it to my iPhone so I could listen to it on the snowy ride into work today. And again, one of those types of podcasts I really enjoy listening to, and I hope you did as well. As I mentioned before, this is just the first podcast in a series of them talking about Avatar. We're going to be speaking next week with John Knoll, VFX supervisor from ILM, about the work they did on the film, as well as some interesting discussions about how they decided what to break up, you know, stuff that they would work on, stuff that Weta would work on, so they weren't kind of duplicating efforts. And then also in the future, we're going to be speaking with the folks at Pixar, as well as Framestore, about work related to the movie as well. Well, that's it for this week. If you have any comments or questions, drop us a line via email to podcast@effectsguide.com. And for my partners, Jeff Huser and Mike Seymour, thanks for listening.
please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.